Okay, I'm on. Okay, perfect. Okay, very good morning, everyone. Welcome to my talk on the asynchronous programming landscape. For those who were in my talk yesterday, this officially is a level 300 talk, I believe. So won't be as deep as it was yesterday. And this time, I do have some slides. So I'm not just going to show ILDASM. Let's dive in straight away. So just a brief intro of myself, maybe. I'm Bart. I'm working in Redmond at the Cloud Programmability team, where I've recently worked on a technology called Reactive Extensions. I'm one of the developers on that. And RX is one of those technologies that is in the asynchronous programming landscape. And I'm actually going to position it by the end of the talk. But I'm going to talk about much more than just RX, because we have quite a few technologies out there that deal with asynchrony. So let's actually get started by taking a look at what this notion of asynchrony really means. And so I've just done a little breakdown of the word here. You know, it has some Greek origin, apparently. That basically means that things are not evolving at the same pace with the same time notion. So the basic idea is that multiple parties, multiple pieces of code, multiple units of execution, multiple tasks, if you will, can evolve at their own pace without basically being blocked for one another. Now, because this has to do with the whole domain of concurrency parallelism, sometimes people are a little confused about all the words. And so I've just given some related concepts here, which I won't really talk about as the primary concern of today's talk, but they are very related. So for example, concurrency basically means that if you have any number of units of work, they're basically unrelated to each other, and what happens is that they can execute in any order. It might be the case they overlap a little, it might be the case that one comes before the other, or that another one becomes for the other one. So that's basically, if there is no ordering, people talk about concurrency. Parallelism is when there is true simultaneous execution happening on the system. For example, if you have a multi-core, many-core machine, you will actually have the capability of multiple units of execution happening at the same time. We'll see, for example, that in RX, in order to be asynchronous, oftentimes you need to introduce concurrency. And introducing concurrency might be done through the TPL, the Task Parallel Library, where you see the word parallel. So all those things are sort of related to each other. Let's just dive into the asynchrony part. So first, a couple of observations. The fact is that today's programs that you write are sort of surrounded by a jungle of asynchronous events coming into the system. So for example, if you have a user, it's definitely the case that the user can evolve his own time independent of the computer. Otherwise, the two are married together and you're basically a human machine or something. So if the user is moving the mouse, he's making that decision, and then your program has to react to that. So the two parties are evolving separately, and typically that happens through event-based systems in that case. Some other cases are when you deal with hardware, for example, when you talk to the network or you talk to something on the network stack, like, for example, a web service request, you get notified when the data of the request becomes available, and then you need to react to that, for example, by means of a callback. Similar with asynchronous I/O operations in the operating system, you're not blocking the CPU while you're doing the I/O operation. It's basically the hardware that says, oh, and by the way, the data is now available at that memory location. Please go and fish it out and do something with it. So that's basically the notion of asynchrony. In a lot of cases, you have what I call native asynchrony, like hardware is native asynchrony. Sometimes you introduce what I would call virtual asynchrony by spawning some worker thread. Like if you say, I'm going to compute the value of pi with a million digits, well, there's no hardware device that does that and tells you I'm done. You're basically going to offer a little piece of the CPU to do that task, and it's going to knock on the door saying I'm at the end of the execution. The value of pi is now available. So those are different places where you can actually have asynchrony. But in a lot of cases, you just deal with what I call native asynchrony, which is the hardware telling you something has happened. I have a lot of words there, like reactive programming, callback-based programming, event-based programming, a lot of terminology that sort of all is in the same fish tank, I would say. So we all know why we want asynchrony. We don't want blocking, so we count two synchronous calls, for example, to the network on the UI thread or read the database from the UI thread in case, you know, the connection might take a long time. So don't block the UI thread is one thing, and there are a lot of ways to do that in different APIs. For example, in WPF, you might use dispatcher.begin invoke after you come back from some unit of work to signal back on the UI thread, but you spawn some additional worker, and then you come back to the UI thread to do the update. Also, because we're connected and we have latency issues, in a lot of cases, asynchrony is much desired. And in fact, for those online platforms or online technologies like Silverlight, WP7, JavaScript, you actually don't have an option other than doing asynchronous stuff. You can't do blocking calls, for example, to a web service in Silverlight. And that's for, of course, you know, a very good reason. So how do we deal with that? One question that I want to answer today is, can we have language support for asynchrony? The answer is yes. We're doing that in C# and VB in the next versions. We also have done that before in F#. But I'm going to talk about the whole domain from a wider angle than just the language. So just a quick recap, asynchrony is everywhere. If you look at MSDN documentation all the way back to the 90s, you would find that the operating system actually supports asynchrony at a very low level. For example, if you're talking about doing asynchronous I/O requests, you have to read up on this notion of completion ports. I'm not going there today, but I'm just pointing out that that's the case, and that the programming model over the years has evolved quite a bit, but you know it all boils down to the capabilities lower on the stack being surfaced through your APIs. So how does that happen in the .NET framework? Here's a little example that's quite buggy. How to do asynchronous file I/O operations. So here what I want to do is I want to open a file called sample.big, and I want to read 4 megabytes of that file without blocking the main thread. So I should be able to move on with my life while that thing is actually reading from the disk. So there are a couple of issues here that already pinpoint things that language support will have to provide. Let's figure out one of those. But first, let's take a look at, you know, the basic idea. As opposed to doing just a synchronous read operation, the asynchronous things, you will always see that you have to specify a little piece of code to come back to. Whether it's a callback, whether it's an event handler, whether it's who knows what, you know, you will have to specify some kind of rendezvous protocol with the I/O stack to say, when the operation is done, execute this piece of code. So you decouple sending the command from receiving the data. So that's actually where we use, in this case, a callback using a lambda expression or an anonymous method, depending on your taste. Now, here's already a problem in this piece of code. If you've learned that whenever you receive an iDisposable object, you better wrap it in a using block or a using statement, that totally doesn't hold when you have asynchrony. The paradigm starts breaking down, because if you do using on this file stream, you're disposing the file stream while the begin read operation, which immediately returns because it's asynchronous, is in flight. So you're actually having a problem here. You need to hold on to the iDisposable and dispose it at the right point in time somewhere in the future, which is kind of tricky to do with a guaranteed, you know, success. So you already see that language support would be much desirable so that you can have a using around an asynchronous operation and let the compiler figure out where the dispose needs to happen. So I'm going to talk about that later. Another thing is, often you see that begin read and end read pairs occur, meaning that, you know, sending the command and receiving the data is decoupled. So I've missed out on that one here. Well, arguably I could say that the green text actually doesn't end read, but you have to be careful not to forget to do that, because even though the callback might come back saying things have been sent into the buffer, there's no guarantee that's really the case until you do an end read. And in fact, you need the end read to know how many bytes were written to the array. So you really need to do that part as well. And then there are some, you know, ugly things from .NET 1.0 sort of surfacing here, like this ugly null that you have to pass in for async state. Well, today we don't really need it anymore if you use lambda expressions or anonymous methods, because you could just have this lambda expression here close over the outer state. Like this guy could perfectly well access the buffer because, you know, it can capture it from the outer scope. In .NET 1.0, you couldn't do that. You needed to pass in a delegate, and then we had a way to communicate some state to the end call. So basically, we threaded that whole thing through the iasync result.state property. So you see some old things remaining here. So we sort of upped the level of the abstractions in the .NET framework. Very brief recap. This is the oldest pattern, begin read, end read. It's basically the same as the read method. All the dots over there are the same as the synchronous version. You just pass in 2 additional things, the callback and the state, and then you have an end read method that uses the async result to correlate the begin with the end. Second pattern that we invented somewhat later is the event-based asynchronous pattern. In fact, you're still passing a callback around, but now the callback is attached to an event handler. So that's basically, it's the same mechanism, but it's just on a different level. And now you don't need to keep track of that iasync result anymore, although if you do multiple download asyncs, you will have to want to correlate in the download completed event handler which one it belongs to. So you might have to do some manual plumbing there using some state object inside the request to actually correlate things together. It's a different way of doing things. It's especially useful if you have components that you can put on a designer surface, just double-click the download completed thing, and you can just hook up an event handler. In fact, lots of APIs only allow one in-flight async operation at a time. So the problem of correlation is not always an issue. Finally, some third one, which in my taxonomy here is not about native asynchrony, but about, you know, fake or virtual asynchrony, is the background worker. In the background worker, you basically have an opportunity to run some background task and communicate, you know, results to, you know, the consumer as well as progress. So this is actually something that you might want to look at as well if you didn't do that before. But the thing that I want to observe here is that whether there are callback functions or events, in reality, you always have some two pieces of code that are active. The thing that sends the command, the thing that receives the data. In this case, it will be something like run worker completed that can fish out the result of the computation. So that's all we have today. I just want to pinpoint the issue of the begin read end read pair just to drive home that little issue. So async C sharp, I have the piece of code that was on the slide. It's a little more extensive because I'm doing the end read operation here. And I'm just reading 4K instead of 4 megs. That doesn't really matter. In fact, it's a little bit deceiving because if I do Control F5 on this piece of code, it immediately completes. And that's not unexpected, of course, because the begin read is not waiting for the data to come back. Like, I'm not synchronizing here. I'm not actually pumping, for example, a UI thread that stays alive during the application's lifetime. So in order to visualize the result, let's just do something like console.read here, right? So that the thing doesn't just quit prematurely. And now you see, oh my god, the bloodhounds are coming out and the thing is just blowing up in my face. And the thing that's happening is that I have this post, you know, as you can see, cannot access a closed file. And that's happening somewhere in the end invoke, which calls end read. So, you know, somewhere in the future, the callback actually came back over here. And it actually came to the conclusion that I already disposed, you know, this file stream object. And the reason is because, you know, my main thread has already moved on with its life. So, you know, lexical scoping together with lambda expressions doesn't work. That's just the very nature of the beast. So, as you can see, not much success here. So, let's move on. Introduce a couple of notions first of further abstractions in .NET 4, and then we'll take a look at language support. So TPL, I'm not going to talk too much about it. The case is that we invented the TPL because we need lightweight parallelism. You know, we need things like task of T as opposed to operating system threads, which scale much better, in particular if you have like machines with 256 cores. This thing parallelizes quite well because it's SQL Server running on the database here or on the machine, but your application most likely is not going to use the 256 cores that effectively. Maybe I'm underestimating, you know, some people here, but, you know. If you can keep them busy, let me know. So true parallelism has become reality, as I'm saying here, so that's really what I mean with parallelism. So what's the main notion of the TPL? The main notion of the TPL, very briefly, is task of T. So task of T is also known as a future. In fact, in the early CTPs and betas of the TPL, it was called future of T. A future is basically something that promises you to return a value T. In fact, a promise is yet another synonym for this, although there are little differences between all of them. But it's basically a little piece of computation that promises you to return an int at some point in time after this long-running computation has finished. So how do you get to that particular value of the thing that's being computed? The way to do it is not by dotting into dot result, because if you dot into dot result on task of T, you're basically blocking till that value becomes available. You can also do polling. You can say task is completed or look at the status and see whether it's completed and sort of do a little busy loop there. But in most of the cases, you actually want to use continuation passing style or CPS. So what's continuation passing style? Again, it's telling that little object what to do when it's done. You have to pass in a piece of code that gets executed when the task actually completes. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm saying, given that task called X, I'm going to continue with and then pass in a lambda that actually allows me to fish out the result. So X2 will be an alias for the X, which is the task that has been completed. The fact we pass it to and not use closures in order to access it is also because closures would do heap allocations. It would be much more expensive for this, you know, ordinary case. So we basically pass an X2, which even could be a different object than X in certain cases. You know, if we would decide to change the TPL and basically give you some shadow proxy task on top of the original one, we are totally fine to do that. Just an implementation detail. But don't rely on the fact that X and X2 really are the same. They just represent the same computation. But now what I can do is I can do something like X2.result safely within that block of code. Because the continuation tells you when the result is available, so fishing it out of the task is no longer a blocking operation. It happens somewhere in the future. That might also actually throw an exception in case, you know, there was an exception thrown during the execution of the task. So then accessing x2.result will actually throw. I think I have that sitting over here. No. But what I'm saying here is that sequencing your code, what to do before and after an asynchronous computation, now has to be done through those lambda expressions. It's not as simple as semicolons anymore. Do this, then do that, then do that. No, you have to lift things into lambdas. So that gets quite ugly quite quickly. So here's an example of doing a long-running operation to actually get some file data. So assume that this task returns a byte array. So get file data returns a byte array. Then the type of report, if I would have a curly, not a curly, a semicolon at the end of the line, the type of report would be task of byte array. But I'm going to do a little bit more in this slide. I'm actually going to do continue with here, which looks as follows. The type of X in the continue with will be the type of the task on the left-hand side, which will be a task of byte array. And now I'm going to fish out the result there, with the risk of actually getting an exception here, in case there was an exception in get file data. I could also do a continuation for the error case. So I could have multiple continuations with certain flags to say, in case there was an error, do this. In case it was successful, do that. You can actually specify that. But then you would already have to have the report variable stored away somewhere and then do multiple continue with calls. And you need to start off plumbing those things together manually. So ignore errors for now. Continue with takes in the task of byte array. X.result will be a byte array. Say that analyze returns a double array, then now the next continue with will actually receive a task of double array and can do the summarize, which might return, I don't know what I chose here. I think I even don't talk about it, but you know, Y.result will be a double array and summarize could say, for example, return a string. And then now report would be a task of string. So that's the way to sequence code. Like, it doesn't look anymore like get file data, assign it to a variable, analyze that thing, assign it to a variable, summarize that thing, assign it to a variable. It's all squeezed into those callbacks. So let's just take a look at the basic notion of task of T, because, you know, just I assume most people have already seen that. But so let's just do, you know, a task of int.factory.startNew. And let's just do a long-running computation, which is really some unique algorithm here. The unique algorithm will be to sleep. I'm a specialist in those algorithms. And I will return 42, the answer to everything. It's getting old, really. So I have this thing now. The task is running. It's sleeping for 5 seconds somewhere on the task pool. And it will return 42. In reality, it's doing much more useful stuff. Just imagine that's the case. But don't dream away. So let's do continue with and say what to do when the task is done. So I will do T underscore, just an alias for T. I could also choose a more meaningful name. I'm not that good with names. And let's do console write line here of T underbar dot result. And in the meantime, my main thread will still be active. I can do something like while T is completed, well, not is completed, I will do on my main thread some useful stuff like drawing a UI. For me, UI is the same as console. So I will just do console.write of a little dot and then do a thread.sleep on the main thread of 500 milliseconds. So I have the most wonderful UI in the world that draws dots while actually the task is going. And ultimately, we'll fall out of this main method. Let's actually do console read just to make sure that I don't have some race condition between this thing actually printing the thing on the screen and this thing saying it's already completed but hasn't run the continuation yet. Can get quite tricky. But you see, I'm drawing dots for 5 seconds, and then 42 will pop out of the continuation call, and my program is finished. And it's not drawing the dots anymore. So you see that continuation now is, you know, sort of sitting in that little lambda expression. So that's the basics of tasks and continuation passing style. Little exercise, the idea of CPS or continuation passing style is that for any given function that takes in a number of arguments and returns a value, you can always create a void returning function with a continuation. That's something to think about. How would you take, for example, an add method with two ints that returns an int into an add method that takes in two ints, some secret sauce, and returns void? Like, that's continuation passing style if everything returns void. So, beautiful exercise. In fact, there are some good books about compiling code using continuations by Andrew Apple. There's actually a nice book on that topic. But, of course, we don't want to go there because the code starts looking ugly. It's just for people who are masochistic like me. Instead, I want to introduce some language support for those kind of asynchronous computations. And one of the languages to prototype and put into production later, this notion of asynchronous language support, is F#. How many have used F#, actually? Okay, not that many, so the syntax will be totally new for most of you, but I will just, you know, introduce it quite quickly. Imagine there is no orange text on the slide, and imagine that the two curly braces over there and over there are not here as well, because really those belong to the async block. But assume there are no orange things on this slide, then I have a function called process async that takes in a value of type int. So that will be an int that ultimately comes from here. And that thing will return something, ultimately, well, it will actually return void. But the way that function would work, if there's no async stuff here, would be I open a file, I read from the file, imagine the async is not here, so it's a blocking operation. I assign the result of reading from the file to a variable called pixels. So let is basically like, you know, assignment and variable introduction. Actually, it's not a variable, it's just a symbolic name, because I can't mutate pixels anymore after I assign it. That's a property of F#. Then I can transform the pixels, assume that's a long-running algorithm that might take some time. Ultimately, I get the pixels, for example, for a pixel shader. And then again, I open a file for writing, and I write to the file, imagine the async is not there, in a blocking way. So now the algorithm at the bottom is basically going to loop through a number of images from one to number of images, and call process async on that. So then I would execute that, and again, if there is no async stuff here, I would sort of trigger those tasks. Then basically, one file would be active, you know, to be pixel shaded at a time. They would execute sequentially. I want to have asynchrony here because, well, there's I/O happening, and we can have multiple outstanding I/O requests at the same time, and assume that the transformation of pixels takes a long time. Well, I could totally be doing the transformation of pixels while another file read or file write is in progress. Like, I can totally overlap those things. So I do want to run things, you know, parallel and actually using asynchrony to actually make that the case. So F# allows you, instead of doing this whole, you know, lifting into continuations and callbacks, it allows you to write asynchronous workflows. So the only changes that you have to make to the original code is everything indicated in orange. You say, this whole piece of code needs to be async, and then you can use async methods over here. You can do that without the async block as well, but you have to choose some other method names here, async read, async write. And instead of assigning things using the let keyword, or the do keyword, or the use keyword, in case you do using, you actually want to use the bang syntax, let bang. And that's the only changes you have to do here. Now, how does this piece of voodoo actually work? The idea is that the compiler transforms this into the code that you would have to write manually otherwise. So it's still doing, you know, taking the pieces of code that need to happen after the completion of an asynchronous call and lifting them into a little function that gets scheduled after the completion of that operation. So for example, those four lines of code get transformed based on the first line here, this let bank pixels equals stream async read, gets turned into something like this, stream.read, numpixels, comma, a continuation function that contains the rest of the code. So that's what the compiler is doing here. He's basically saying, oh, I'm doing an asynchronous kind of assignment here. This thing now needs to call into a function that accepts the rest of the computation as a callback. So it's basically lifting that thing out just like you would have to do it yourself. Now we have a do bank sitting over here. Recursively, the compiler will rewrite this thing as well using a function that's used for the continuation. So it just continues doing that, and your code starts to look very much indented, right? Because you always have a callback and a callback and a callback and a callback. So that's what F-sharp is doing here. Ultimately, I can do something like async.parallel of all those tasks, and then things are really happening simultaneously. So this is kind of nice. So just to summarize this feature, and then I will actually show it in practice, it's a more general feature than for asynchrony. Again, it's based on some fancy theory, but the idea is that workflows in F-sharp don't need to be asynchronous. It's a general purpose feature that allows you to overload the meaning for let bang, do bang, and use bang, which are those three magic keywords. So the idea it's based on is continuation passing style. This is sort of the transformation that the compiler is doing, and actually that already reveals my little exercise that I pointed out earlier. If you have a synchronous function that takes in something of type A and returns something of type B, say something that takes in an int and returns another int, to make it asynchronous, you basically make a new function that takes in A, the input parameters, as well as a little function that receives the result when it's done. That's the continuation. And now the whole thing returns unit, which means it returns void. So that's basically the transformation that the compiler is doing. The nice thing is you don't have to know because the compiler is taking care of it for you. And so the core concept is that you can have a keyword, curly braces, and some code, and basically this keyword gets turned into library calls, like, you know, async corresponds to an async method builder or something, for which all those, you know, keywords correspond to method calls on that async builder. So that's basically how that feature is actually extensible. So you can actually introduce your own kind of, you know, aspect in the code. It doesn't need to be async. That's a very advanced feature, but if you want to search for that, search for workflows in F#. And as you can see here, yeah, this is exactly the same signature, almost like continue with. Again, you have callbacks. That's the way of life with asynchrony. So let's take a look at a little demo here of async in F#. And then we go to C#. So here's a little sample that downloads HTML from a number of websites simultaneously. So I want to download all those search engines here. And the little function I define here is an HTTP function that, if you can see it from the back, otherwise I will read it, it's a function HTTP that takes in a string, that's the URL, and returns an async string. Async string is pretty much the same as task of string in the TPL, plays a similar role in the world of F#. So the way it works is we first create a web request using the URL, and that happens synchronously. There is no bang sitting here. If there would be a bang, it would try to do something asynchronous, but there is no asynchronous create method, so it already starts complaining. So once I created the request, I want to get the response asynchronously because that's the time where there's lots of latency in the system. I don't want to block for the response to become available. I want to do it asynchronously. So I say async get response, use bang, and then I just continue writing code. If I wouldn't do it like this, I would really have to do something like async get response, pass in a function, that's the continuation, and then has the rest of the code. So I would have to indent things manually myself, and it wouldn't already be possible to even return from that little lambda. It becomes all non-compositional at that point in time. So in F# you can just say let it be. I just say use bang here, which is, by the way, a using block that will dispose the thing at the right time now. Like F# knows how to do the dispose at the right point in time. So now using starts just to work with asynchrony as well. So use bang the response, and all the rest actually happens synchronously after the response comes back. If I would write things to disk, for example, I would likely introduce another let bank that will correspond to the write to disk part of the algorithm. But this is really the only long running call. So then I have a number of sites here. I just say something for each site in the sites. Call this HTTP function. The site is of type string. HTTP of site will be of type async of string, which contains the HTML of the file. And then I can give that to some function called async.parallel, which will spawn parallel workers for that. And ultimately, I want to synchronize all those guys that only I continue when all the results are available. And then I just print them on the screen. So if I execute this thing, and in fact, I should install Fiddler, then you would actually see that there were four web service requests or four web requests sort of happening simultaneously, because I have async get response for those four parallel tasks happening at the same time, because I'm parallelizing the whole algorithm here. So to summarize this feature, instead of writing this piece of code, you can now write this piece of code. That's the idea. So now, let's take a look at how we take that to more mainstream languages like C# and VB in the next version of the languages. So at the PDC last year, we actually announced this feature. We have CTPs available for it. So if you have .NET 4 today, you can download the CTP for async and start playing with that. And I will give you a couple of demos here in just a moment. So what do we introduce in this CTP is the following. Two new keywords for C#. And in VB, a very similar thing. VB gets some additional features, such as iterators in the next go-around as well, which we didn't have in VB, only in C#. But so here you see two methods. The first thing you notice is that they have an async modifier on their signature. So those are what we call asynchronous methods. Not very original, I agree, but you know that's why we chose the word async. Now, inside those functions, you can use a new keyword called await. That's the second keyword of the feature. Those are the only two keywords you need to know about. In fact, if you forget the async, it will tell you. So like you really only need to know await, and then the rest sort of falls out. So what does this thing do? Well, await is really the same as that let bank syntax in F#. It just happens in a slightly different position in your code. So the thing I want to do here is I want to download two websites, acme.com and xyznews.com, and I want to do that asynchronously. And I'm actually going to walk through how this code executes. So let's take a look. Assume that I have a UI thread with a message pump, because this is a UI application, that calls do work async, say for example from a button handler, a button click handler. So things will start to run because somebody calls do work async. So when we call do work async, we really allocate a little task in here that will correspond to process feed async. So we need to have an object that represents the computation that's in flight, so that we can basically check, is it already done, whatever. So that's the first thing that happens. Now, process feed async, of course, is something that is a method call, so we'll go into that method call. This is the task that corresponds to the process feed async. The red bar on the white line here will be the occupation of the thread, the UI thread, with work. So we'll actually see, ultimately, the goal is that while we're downloading this thing, there will be pauses of white so that the UI can pump messages. If it would be a blocking call, this thing would be read all the way to the end till all the results come back. We don't want that. We want to get Swiss cheese here with lots of holes in it. Well, have to be careful to name countries of cheese in Holland, right? So any kind of cheese you like with holes in it. So we call into process feed async. Process feed async will call into a function called download feed async. Now download feed async might live in the BCL. Assume it lives in the BCL. We'll get a little a little task again that corresponds to running download feed async. So we have a little ticket, sort of, that we can poll. Is something happening? Is it done? We can register continuations, whatever. So at that point, and this is one of the key things here, at that point, the download feed async is running. It's going somewhere. IO requests are being made in the system behind the scenes. But as you can see, I've returned over there to my main thread. I've returned to, not to the main thread, to the caller of the function. So I'm back in do work async. I've assigned that little piece of work to T1, and the rest of the method hasn't even executed yet. So it's as if this method has been paused, awaiting the result to come in to actually start executing the rest of the code. So that method is just sitting there idling. It's not burning any CPU. It's even not eating a thread because it's hanging up to an I/O request. So next, we do the same thing, exactly the same thing for T2. T2 will call into process feed async. That thing will encounter some call that goes to the network. The await will say, it's not done yet. I can just return to my caller. Like, I know how to continue in the future when the data becomes available. So it actually bails out there as well. And then our method here, doWorkAsync, says, well, I really need to have the results of both web service calls or web calls for acme.com and xyznews.com. So I'm using something called task.whenAll, which basically creates a new task that represents the completion of the two other tasks. Now, no matter what you have programmed in the past, whether it's .NET with, you know, wait handle or Win32 with wait for multiple objects EX, like, that's the same principle. It's the idea of having multiple things you can synchronize on and now creating a new synchronization mechanism for all of those. So we have wait all and wait any. Wait any would complete when any of them has completed. So task.whenAll is a task object that I've allocated here somewhere. I don't know why I already had the animation. There it is. That's now a new task that only will be completed when T1 and T2 are both completed. Okay? Now, that clearly is not the case yet because download fate async for those two calls is still in flight. It's still going. So at this point, you know, we're hitting an await block here, and this method simply returns. We're back in the button click event handler. We haven't done display message done yet because that can only happen when the two tasks complete. So that's scheduled to happen later on. Now assume at some point download feed async for xyznews.com, T2, completes. So we got the feed actually downloaded. Now we start executing all the blue code here up to the next await point. That's happening, you know, because that request is done. So we're parsing the feed into a document, assuming that's a short-running operation, because otherwise you might want to do that asynchronously as well, of course, not to block anything. But notice that we had some white time on the UI thread where the UI can pump messages to remain responsive. Or another web service call might come in case this is a web server that's executing. You're not blocking your thread for the incoming web service request. You can basically yield and have somebody else coming in. Like, you can basically reuse those threads. So the blue text has actually executed. We're hitting save doc async, which again, you know, allocates a new task that represents the completion of writing to the document. But that might also take a long time. So the method says, I'm done for now. I'm sort of waiting or awaiting the result of writing to the document. I'm just going to suspend the method again. So this code, the process log write entry, is not happening yet. It's sitting there waiting for the thing to come back without burning CPU cycles. So at some point in the future, that might be done. So you see, like, save doc async has been completed. And now we execute the blue text to actually write an entry to a log file. So now that whole task, or that whole process feed async, is done, which ultimately means that T2 is done, which means that task.whenAll is not done yet because T1 hasn't completed. So we are sort of halfway through. Now assume exactly the same thing happens for T2, meaning that the feed for T2 is actually done at some point. And as a response to that, at some point, we saved the document. So again, we went through the two same motions for T1. This whole thing happens. Ultimately, those two things, which represent the completion of process feed async, have been done. So now the task when all can also complete. And so ultimately, the code here in the main method, after the await for both tasks, starts executing as well. So we enter the UI thread again to do the display message of done. So you see, like, we can pass those methods on the await boundaries, and then the rest of the computation happens whenever the result is ready. So we exit methods prematurely. Now, in those methods, you can have everything. You can have if keywords, whiles, force, try, catch, finally, using. All of that stuff just works. The compiler just does a lot of stuff to make that happen. But it's pretty nifty. Yep, question. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, after the await, on which thread are you back? It depends on the object you're awaiting. So awaiting a task of T does some nifty stuff with synchronization context to guarantee that you get back on the UI thread. So we can actually do that. The thing is that await is a more general feature than with task of T. You can actually implement the await pattern on any object, and then it's actually subject to what the object wants to do, how it will synchronize and come back. So say that you would do a naive wrapper to begin read and read using await. In that case, the end read call, sort of, you know, the continuation happens on the IO completion worker pool, which is background thread. If you wouldn't do some synchronization contexting, you would indeed have the code after the await running on a different thread than the code before the await. However, most of the await implementations will actually guarantee some synchronization. Because otherwise it's totally weird, right? Like, in this case, you would end up with code that, you know, before the await you're on the UI thread and you don't get an exception that you're writing to the UI, updating a label or something. And then after the await, when I do something like display message over here, it would complain that you're on a different thread. That would be kind of weird. Parse feed into doc might take a long time. Yeah, if parse feed into doc takes a long time, you would basically say task.factory.createNew of that parse feed into doc. Then you have a task and you can await it. And then that thing will happen on the background thread and the rest of the UI will be updated as soon as the task is done. So you can now start lifting more and more stuff into await, depending on your needs, of course. You had another question? Yep. Yeah, so over here, why do you want the async modifier? It's part for clarity, it's part for consistency. So the thing is that we also have async on Lambda expressions. Now I'm going really deep. But you can have an async Lambda. Now, Lambda expressions sort of morph to whatever type the corresponding parameter of a method needs to be, right? See that you have a method called bar that takes in a func that returns either, say, an int or a task of int. Now, the return type is an int in one case, a task of int in another case. Depending on the async modifier, we can now know that we need to choose the overload that returns a task of int. So we need the modifier there, otherwise you need to specify on the Lambda expression what the return type is, and you can't, because that syntax doesn't allow to specify the return type. So we basically said we need the async modifier on Lambda expressions. Well, then it's totally weird that we don't have it on methods. And having it on methods also allows, of course, code analysis tools to see, like, oh, you have a very chatty communication with 1,500 async things after each other. That might not be as efficient as you think it is. So it's part for clarity, and it's part for consistency. Two process feed asyncs on different cores. That would be the case. Well, in this case, it doesn't make much sense in some respect, because download feed async will be I/O calls, right? But say that you do over here create a new task to do the parse feed into doc. Then you know you would actually have two tasks for the two feeds that are on the task pool, and the task pool will parallelize on different CPUs in case they are available. So it's basically compiling into the TPL, and hopefully that thing does the right thing in that case. One more thing is async methods can return void task or task of something. So if you have, for example, an async method that returns task of int, in that method you can just return an int and it will become a task. So that's you know, what async methods can return, because the whole computation of the method is now delayed to the future, right? So other questions about this? I will actually show it in just a moment. Yep. Oh, cancellation tokens, okay. That's going to be part of a pattern. So the pattern will be that if you have a synchronous method called bar, you now can have a bar async method. And in case you want to support cancellation, you will pass in a cancellation token at the very end. So you will basically thread through cancellation tokens as the last parameter of async methods. And at the place where you can grant cancellation by looking at cancellation requested property or, you know, throw if canceled, you will actually do so whenever you see fit, because it's cooperative cancellation. So the language doesn't know about cancellation. Maybe in the future you might see, and this is totally hypothetical, and that's totally my personal idea. Like, if there are 1,500 ways of canceling, ultimately in the framework, you might see a cancelable method at some point. No guarantees there, but you know, at this point it will be a pattern so that you have a method and you pass in cancellation tokens. Okay. And same for progress reporting. Progress reporting, in case you have some long-running operation, and you might actually want to pass in some func that signals out whenever the progress has been updated or something. Like, those are not part of the language, because otherwise await keyword starts to be kind of fat, right? You know, an await with multiple parameters would be weird. Yeah. Okay, so let's take a look at a little demo. It's a demo that we've actually available as part of the CTP. So that means that you can take a look at it at home and basically see exactly the same thing I showed you. In fact, the async CTP, you can just download async CTP over here. Just download that. Now you need, I don't want to conduct a survey. Normally I always click yes, you know. So yeah, you want to install Visual Studio 2010 Service Pack 1 to install the CTP. It actually replaces the compiler, the language services, so that you have syntax highlighting. Ultimately, it will become part of the next version of the framework or the language. So that's what you install, and then you can basically find a lot of demos in documents, Visual Studio Async CTP samples. You will also find the language specification over here, which is just incremental specification saying what the additional things are added to the language. So it's not very much. It contains even a couple of samples, so it's not very much. So if you want to see some spec, you can find it. So here's an example. Let me actually try to find where I am. So that's async today, that's sync. Load movies. So here I have an example of a Netflix demo. Let's actually run it, 2010 search. It's going to search movies from the internet, and it wants to download those pictures simultaneously, because otherwise I'm blocking the UI thread till I get all the movies from 2010. And getting all the movies from 2010, like you see, there are already 410 here, even more, will be a long time, and your UI will be totally unresponsive if you try to do that just on the main thread. Cancelled. Oh, we actually cancelled because I have some, you know, don't take more than 10 seconds to execute this thing, then we automatically cancelled. That's part of the demo. But so that's the application we want to build. Today, if you want to do it synchronously, you would write some method called loadMovies, given the year that comes from the UI, from some button click, right? And in there, you will do something like update the UI, searching titles, right? And then do query movies and do that in a while loop through till you basically get no movies back anymore from some background service. So you're basically getting pages back, and if you get an empty page at the end, you will basically bail out of that loop. And the reason I'm using a while loop and a try-catch here is to show that it gets quite ugly if you try to... I'm just doing an avoid, you know, cancelled exception kind of thing here. But the idea is I have lots of control flow in the middle of some synchronous code, and that's totally fine. Synchronous code and control flow are two brothers, you know, walking hand in hand. Well, or brothers and sisters or whatever. So that's what's going on. Query movies is a method that's synchronous again. It takes in some stuff. The reason I'm passing in cancellation tokens here is to show the diffs between the synchronous and the asynchronous code as being as minimal as possible. So that's just, I'm even not using it in this case, I believe. And it's returning a movie array. So that's very synchronous again, right? You know, you do query movies for the year. You say which page you're on, how many items you want to get, and then we do a download string, get data back, put it in some link to XML query, and pump out the movies. So that's what we're doing here. Now let's take a look at how we actually write exactly the same code today in an asynchronous manner. So load movies async becomes a little bit like this. Not readable. So what I want to do ultimately is I want to call some method called query movies async. Just like in the synchronous case, I want to call query movies. But what do you want to pass to query movies if it becomes asynchronous? That's all the code to execute upon downloading the movies for that particular batch. What's the rest of the code that needs to execute after the first batch is downloaded? Well, it's this code. It's going back to this code. It's making sure there is a try-catch block around it. So, like, really, query movies async needs to take in a lambda expression that will execute this piece of code, loop back over here. Like, how do I do that? Well, the answer is, it's tricky. So what I have here is a recursive lambda expression. Like I have an action of movie array with an exception that's being threaded through, and now I have an action that has movies and exception coming in somehow, and then I can pass in that same action at some point to query movies async over here so that it comes back to the beginning, and oh my goodness, my brain has exploded. So that's not very nice. Query movies async, pretty similar story. Query movies async originally, and that's the whole point of, you know, asynchrony, it needs to return void because it doesn't have the result yet. So it needs to take in a function that will receive the movies that have been downloaded. So you see the transformation returns void now, and some function that takes in the movies, in this case also an exception because we need to do some exception handling. So I need to pass that thing in, and now inside, oh my goodness, once more it starts to look a little ugly. I have a web client. In the past, I just did webClient.downloadString. Now I want to do webClient.downloadString async somewhere. I don't know where I do that. That's over here. So I want to do an async download. But to do an async download, you need to register an event handler that signals when the download is completed. So now the code that needs to run last needs to appear first in my method. Like, you know, I need to hook up the event handler first, which is the thing I'm doing here. Download string completed plus equals sender comma e, that's the code to execute when the thing is done. And when that thing is done, ultimately I will call that continuation function process movies that was passed in to continue the rest of the computation. You don't want to be in this position, okay? So in the next version of C Sharp, you basically do the following. Load movies async, let's actually overlay it with the original synchronous code over here. Here we go. Load movies took in an int of year and returned void. It now becomes async load movies async with an int year. Not much has changed. Can you see the other difference? Has an await in front of it. That's the only difference I have to do for this method to make it asynchronous. The compiler does exactly the same madness as I did before myself. But you don't have to do it anymore. So that's the change to this piece of code. You can do try catches around it. You can do everything around it. In fact, I even use the cancelled exception in this case to update the UI because I can now. In the past, that would be very tricky to do. And then, you know, the query movies async method over here compared to the query movies method, again, returns async. It doesn't return a movie array, but it returns a task of movie array, which is something that produces a movie array in the future. So that's the other difference. For the rest, it's exactly the same, other than this line, where instead of doing download string, I now do download string task async. And those things ultimately will end up in the BCL. Currently, they live in some extension methods namespace as part of the CTP. But ultimately, you will see methods with an async suffix that return a task. And you can await those methods in an async method. So now, again, you know, I'm starting a download, and when the download is completed in the future, I will do my link to XML magic. My link to XML magic will simply return movies.toArray, so that's an important thing. Movies.toArray returns a movie array. An async method, you can return this part, even though the return type is task of that thing. It automatically gets wrapped into a task object. That's another part of the feature here. And so that's the only two changes I had to make to the code, and now the whole thing is responsive and asynchronous. So let me actually just show how bad it was to execute this thing synchronously. In fact, we'll be able to watch movies by the end of the talk. Like here we go, it's blocked already. So that's the async version. The async version you already saw before, that's the synchronous version with, you know, the simple looking code but totally blocking code. This might take up to 5 minutes to complete. By that time, people have clicked on this thing, and in this particular case, you can't even click that. So it's kind of dramatic. Yep. Uh-huh. No, you don't have to do the begin invoke. You don't have to do the this.invoke or dispatcher begin invoke, because basically awaiting a task remembers the current synchronization context, and when the await completes, it comes back to that synchronization context. So you don't even have to do this.invoke here. Yep. Okay. No movies yet. So far for this particular part, Now I want to talk a little bit about Rx and show you how those two worlds are complementary. They really are. So reactive extensions is this thing I've been working on together with the team for, you know, about 4 years, 5 years. We've shipped it the last 1.5 years. And it's basically a system to do event processing. Now, how many of you have already seen it and used it? Okay, couple. How many have been to the talk of Mike Talty this week? Okay, quite a few. So you will be able to tell me whether we say the same thing about Rx. So the observation is the following. Around us, we have a lot of event streams. Event streams of things like stock tickers, RSS feeds. If you look at HTML5 and JavaScript, you have, for example, GPS coordinate services or the geolocation API, which basically can give you a stream of data whenever the location of the user changes. Things like UI events, social media like Twitter, those things are reactive APIs. They basically send you data as soon as something happens. So your application is the poor guy in the middle who needs to handle all those events coming in and often needs to coordinate them. Sometimes you might want to merge multiple streams of events. Sometimes you want to time out some events, like a lot of things you might want to do. So again, it's event-based, so it has to do something with asynchrony, right? And I will point out the difference between this and the async CTP stuff by the end of the talk. So the thing we do is the following. Rx is a library, so we don't make changes to the language, the compilers, as opposed to the async CTP. And we don't change the runtime either, so it's just a library. That allows you to do asynchronous event-based programming, and the most important part is actually the event-based part, and I will point out the difference between the two concepts. It's compositional, meaning that if you have two event streams, and I will show you what an event stream looks like in just a moment, if you have multiple of those event streams, you can glue them together without lots of code, and you end up with a new event stream. So it's as simple, for example, if you have an event stream and you want to filter it, you can do event stream.where, pass in a lambda function, and you have a new event stream that's filtered. It's not like writing an event handler and then do an if in there, and oh my goodness. So it's very compositional. Finally, we do this whole thing through the lenses of sequences. We call them observable sequences. And because they're sequences, you can use link syntax on top of it. So that's one of the values of Rx. So you can download this thing. Actually, we published one day ago the final shape of the API for version 1.0. And actually, I've been uploading the downloads, which is kind of funny, the last couple of hours. So they might already be up. Here they are. So this is the old version from 2.11. Happens to be my birthday. It was a very happy day. We also have now v1.0 and v1.1. V1.1 is kind of experimental, so we are noodling around with a lot of new things there. V1.0 is the subset of the entire release we commit to as being the final shape of the API for version 1.0. So you can download it for many platforms over here. I'm actually still using the previous version here because my demos haven't been updated for this one, so bear with me. Okay, very good question. Will Rx be part of the next framework? At this point, the idea is that we don't go in the framework other than for the interfaces. And the reason is a couple of things. We want to be very flexible in changing things, meaning, you know, having quick iterations, like every few months we want to have a new release. That's the same, for example, with the Entity Framework forks. They are now also taking out part of their release into separate downloads. Really, the framework has gotten quite big, and we think like modularizing it makes a lot of sense. It's also the case that installing those libraries is very friction-free using package managers like NuGet. So that's basically the current philosophy. We are not putting the entire thing in the framework, just the base primitives, the base elements, which are the interfaces. So it's basically, as you can see on the thing here, including the MSI fluff around it and all the XML files for documentation, it's like 1.4 megabytes. And really, the library is like 500K. So it's a very small thing. So, oh, the slides are going automatically. That's pure magic. Woo, that was fancy. So the thing I want to tell here is sequences, the word sequence, we already sort of know. Everyone knows what an enumerable sequence is. Like, for example, if you have a link to SQL query, you get an enumerable sequence where you can get the results of the database query. So that's what we call interactive programming, where the application basically asks the environment, in this case a database server, do you have a next value for me? In that case, I proceed with my life and render it on the UI. But you are blocked while you're waiting for that result to come in. In the observable world, the roles are kind of different. The initiator of the communication is now the environment telling you that new data becomes available. So think, for example, about something like NASDAQ stock exchange for this particular case. You're not enumerating the stock exchange in order to get, you know, stock ticker data back. You're basically once telling the stock ticker or the stock exchange, please tell me whenever this thing goes up or down. And from that point on, the thing starts sending you messages saying something has happened, something has been updated. So it's a push-based model. You're not sitting there taking data out of the stock exchange. It just happens to travel to you, and you have to react to it. So that's a very event-driven system, right? So those are the two interfaces which actually are in the BCL, as I answered in the previous question. So you'll find iObservable and iObserver in the system namespace. And those are the two basic mechanisms of Rx. So just briefly, an iObservable is something that represents a data store that can send you events. And the way to actually get to those events is by subscribing to the thing by giving it an observer. Now, giving it an observer is pretty much the same as specifying a callback function. There you already see the asynchrony part coming in, right? You're giving it something to call you back. That's exactly the same as begin, read, end, read, continue with, async, all of that stuff, exactly the same mechanism. We can come back to you on the iObserver in three ways. We can tell you that a value is available, like, for example, the stock exchange is giving you the next value for a particular ticker. It can tell you something terribly went wrong, because there was, for example, a bomb attack to the stock exchange. Then they say, I'm sorry, I can't give you any results anymore. And they can also go bankrupt, and then they say, we're completed, we're done, don't wait for results anymore, it's not going to happen, I'm sorry. So those are the three things we can come back with. Now, the thing is that you can have multiple calls to on next, as opposed to all the async stuff. Like if you have a task of T, you continue with on the task of T, that lambda is only going to execute once to tell you we're done. It might contain a value, it might contain an exception, but that's the end of it. With event streams, you can basically specify an observer and receive zero to infinity number of calls to on next. So you can get one message, which is the same as async. You can have a million messages or an infinite number of messages. Like mouse moves will call an infinite number of times on next for every time you move the mouse. So that's the essential difference. So now I don't know what demo Mike actually did. I'm going to do the typical demo here of Rx, which is dictionary suggest. You might have seen it many times. But that basically proves a lot of points. And I'm not going to take a look at the code here. I'm just going to start writing some code. So what I have here, and in fact, let me put all of that stuff on the clipboard because I want to rebuild it. I want to have some fun here. So what I've started with is a little application that renders a UI with a text box and a list box. I'm using C# and JSON style, so I don't need a UI designer, which is good. I just run the application, and here we go. We have a fancy application with a text box and a list box. The idea of the application will be whenever I type something here, I get, you know, responses for all the words that start with the input. So if I type React here, I want to see reactive, reactor, reactants, you know, whatever, all of those words. So how do I do that today? Well, you could hook up an event handler to, you know, text change, then do lots of stuff there. Now it happens that things get a little tricky if you want to do slightly more. So let me actually start by doing this thing reactively and point out a couple of interesting things. So the first thing you want to do in this case is because you want to compose events from a web service with events from the UI, you sort of want to bring all of those things together in the same abstraction, which is iObservable. So we need to build a couple of bridges to iObservable of T, and then we can use a rich set of operators provided by the reactive extensions. So the reactive extensions is just an assembly called system.reactive that you have to add to your project. In fact, this already uses the new version. It's version 0.0. That's because I built it locally. So that's what our build system does. But so in the past, for those of you who have used it, we had system.coreact and system.reactive. Now we only have system.reactive. and we spawned off all the stuff that has to do with UI programming in separate assemblies. So we don't have references to, say, system.windows.forms in system.reactive if you're using it in a web service. That doesn't quite make sense. In this case, I use System Reactive and System Reactive Windows Forms, which are the two assemblies I care about. So let's start by taking a look at the iObservable interface, just to whet the appetite. Once you're on the ship of an iObservable of T, you get a whole set of methods to do event processing. That's the reason you want to be there, in case you want to do something complex. So as you can see, it's quite big. Now, how do I get from a .NET event, like text.txt changed, onto an iObservable? The answer is you want to bridge it, and the way to bridge it is by using an operator called observable.fromEventPattern. In the past, if you used Rx, you only had fromEvent. Now we have two of them, fromEventPattern and fromEvent. What you pass in here is the target of the event, which will be the text box, and you can pass in the fact I want to listen to text changed. You also have overloads where you can pass in lambda expressions instead of using reflection-based APIs. But that's totally fine. That's just a one-time hit.
Why do you still need to pass in a string and text change?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
Why does it have to be a string and not some kind of object?
I can do it. So the question is, why do I have to pass in text change as a string here? The fact is that .NET events are not first class. So if you do text change like this, you can't assign an event to an object. You can't have an object being passed into a constructor or whatever. So we need to grab it somehow. We can grab it in two ways. We can grab it through reflection, or we can ask you to give us two functions, a function how to attach an event handler and how to remove an event handler. I could do that too, but it's a little more clunky. I need to do h goes to txt.textchanged plus equals h, and then I need to do the same thing with minus equals h. You basically need to tell Rx, how do I attach to this thing and how do I detach from it? So in a lot of cases, I find it easier to just do this, but not misspell it.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. You can totally do it using the other overloads as well. I just want to show how small the code gets. And with all those lambdas, it gets a little bigger. I'm a salesman now. So let's call that thing input. So what's the result of this doing from event pattern? You also don't have to specify any more generic parameters in the next version of Reactive. So that's a nice thing. Now that I have that, I can subscribe to the input. And to subscribe to the input, you either give it an observer, which is that callback mechanism that can get on next, on error, on completed, or you pass in lambda expressions for the three methods, how to do an on next, how to do an error, how to do an on completed. I just care about values because, text box cannot fail, as far as I've been told, and it never completes. So I will just say text goes to console right line text. Let's see what that actually gives me. Oops. Whoa. That's not the text coming out of the text box, right? The thing I get back from doing from event or from event pattern is an object that contains both the sender and the event args. That's just the data you got from .NET events to begin with, right? So we still give you all that data. So the next question is, how do I get to the text, really? Text is really an object, which I will call E. I can do E.EventArgs, E.Sender. But, EventArgs, in this case, it doesn't have a text on it. So you can't fish it out of the event. That's just the nature of UIs. They have text change, but they don't give you the string together with the text changed event. So you might, of course, want to say exactly the thing you did before in classic, event handling. You might want to say, I'm going to cast the sender to a text box, and then I can fish out the text, right? That's one thing you could do just to get to the text box. So if I do that, it already fails somehow. When in doubt, add parentheses. So as you can see, it just works now. But that's kind of ugly, because now I have lots of imperative code in my event handler. Can't I do a better job? I have an iObservable of event patterns that contains senders and event args. Can't the text box just be an iObservable of string, which is like a sequence of strings that come through the system? The answer is yes, I can totally do that using Rx. I can say, the input I want to write a query on, from E in from event pattern, select and then this whole ugly thing, like this, without one more parentheses, I think. Yep, like this. And now input actually started with event objects, with sender and event types, and now becomes a sequence of strings. I've projected out the values into a sequence of strings. So I can start writing those queries to transform my events. And now I can just do, well, now it's not E anymore, it's a word for me. And word is a string, as you can see, because I have substring, and those kind of methods available. So this is now a system.string. So now I have a sequence of strings. That's pretty nice. Now, given a sequence of strings, I want to go to a web service ultimately. But as you can see, there is some little problem here. The fact if the user types a lot, you go to the web service for every single hit of the key. That's not the thing I want to do. I want to basically go to the web service only when the user slows down typing. He doesn't type for half a second anymore. So how would you do that with classic.NET events? Well, you would have an event handler that triggers every time text change happens, and then you would have to start up some timer, wait for the timer to happen. If the timer happens within a certain interval, then you want to do this, that, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't want to be there. How do you do that using Rx? Well, using Rx, it's pretty simple. You say, well, I have an event sequence sitting here. I want to throttle it down, so that it can only produce things if, you know, they age for at least half a second. So that means if the user types reactive R and E within half a second, the R doesn't come out, the RE doesn't come out, until the user stops for half a second. So I'm basically throttling it down. That will save me a lot of money going to a web service. So if I now go here and I type really fast, I can even correct myself and type reactive, and then I stop for half a second, then the event comes out. We can do all of that plumbing just in a compositional manner. You have an iObservable, you throttle it, you still have an iObservable. But now it's modulo, you know, timing stuff. Now it's even more interesting because I can do backspace E here. Oh, if I do backspace E as a user, I have two reactive things in the same stream subsequently. I don't want to go to the web service again when the user does this little, you know, typing thing here, because it's going to be the same web service call anyway. How can I filter out those consecutive duplicates? Regular.NET events, you can do that. You just store a field, have an equality compare, do this and that, and dance a little bit around. you know, that works. But in Rx, you can just say distinct until changed, like this. And we do all of that dance for you. So if you use this, see, you know, Bart and Eric Meyer and all those people dancing in the hallway. So that's what we do. I type reactive again. You know, I'm doing this little dance here. It doesn't come out anymore because the things are duplicates. Now, I wasn't quick enough to insert an E again. I waited for half a second, and now it's reactive without the E. So that's what you see. And now we get reactive again because, of course, well, it's only adjacent duplicates that we filter out here. You can also filter out all the duplicates by using distinct, which consumes more memory because we need to remember the whole past. But so that's what we have here. Now I want to glue that thing together to wrap up with a web service call so that we actually get, you know, suggestions for the word that the user is typing. So allow me now to cheat and copy some piece in here. This is just a bridge to go to a WCF web service, which I've already added here. I've added the web service reference. And the web service actually contains begin and end pairs, begin read and read pairs. We can actually expose those as iObservable collections as well. So basically, you know, an event that produces a single value, like an asynchronous call to a web service, can also be an iObservable of a single value, right? So we have a bridge to that. We also have bridges to convert task of T to an iObservable so that you can start writing those big queries on tasks as well. So here I'm just importing the web service method that takes in three strings, which is the word, the dictionary, and how to search. Those are the three things that my web service actually needs from me. Let me actually just show the web service. It's sitting over here. Match in dict, I have to say the dictionary to search in, the word to search for, and the strategy. Those are the three strings that are passed in there. And so if I do that, all the words that start with React in the WordNet dictionary, I get some results back. So I just have a bridge now to that with iObservables. Now that I have that, I will just write a little query here. I can explain it, you know, after we're done, because I'm just have half a second here, or half a minute. I'll just paste in the query. That's all you have to do to compose the input from the text box with web service calls from the web proxy. It's basically like a from, select, and then something called switch. That basically switches, you know, between all the requests. If the user does a new request while an existing one is in flight, we cancel out the previous one and start a new one. We sort of just switch from request to request while the user is typing. And now that I have that, I can basically do something like results.subscribe, and I can basically update the UI. What's coming back is words, like this. And what's words? Words is the result of the web service call. It's a dictionary word array. I can render that in the UI, right? I can say something like list.items.clear, and now I can do list.items.addRange of all the words. And then my UI should be updated. So let's try and execute this thing. I can say React over here. Ultimately, the web service comes back. Oh my goodness, something bad happens. We don't have automatic synchronization in Rx because, well, if you always handshake with a synchronization context, the throughput of the system goes down. So you can insert very easily how to synchronize on which context in Rx. So in this case, the only problem is that the callback happens on a background thread and we need to be on the UI thread. The way to solve that in Rx is not by doing a dance with this.invoke. Instead, you say result, they come out on the wrong place, I want them to come out somewhere else. You say observe on the Windows form. That's the way to take an iObservable of T that's sitting in the wrong place to an iObservable of T that is executing in the right place. So very simple compositional thing to do that. So again, let's execute it. It won't blow up anymore. So I do React. Whoops. What I get back is the two string methods on dictionary word, which is generated by the web service proxy. So you already see that it's sort of working. I still need to shape them up so that they fit in the list box. So words are dictionary words. Dictionary words contain the dictionary ID and the word. How do I get from a list of dictionary words to a list of strings which contain the words? I can just use link to objects, right? So let's just write that. From word in words, select word dot word. Kind of wordy, but you know. That's essentially what you would do all the time using link to objects. So now that I do that, I just have a few lines of code with timers and all of that stuff and duplicates that combines asynchronous event streams from the UI with asynchronous event streams from the web. Pretty easily, pretty effectively. So a lot of operators there. So how does this relate to the async stuff we've been talking about before? Well, here's actually the overview I actually want to stop with. The little gap in this line is actually by design. Something will actually fit nicely on top of that when the slide builds up. So this is the landscape I promised you in the title of the talk. And there are four quadrants. Either you get to data synchronously or asynchronously. Either your data contains one value or multiple values. Depending on the case, you want to choose one of the quadrants. So let's talk about synchronous and asynchronous single value things first. The language is great at doing synchronous single-value computation. It's called a method call. It's called a property lookup. It's called an indexer call. It's called a constructor. All of those language features are about synchronous completion of one value. So func of t is the type I want to compare with. It's something that returns a type t or value of type t, and you basically get it synchronously, so invocation expressions. If you have asynchronous computations of a value of type t, you can now do in the language await of that thing. That's the language feature on that level to deal with single value asynchronous computations. There are a lot of those things around, so that's where you want to use await. Sequencing happens through those semicolons, which is the way to do one thing after the other in a language like C#. In Visual Basic, it's just carriage return line feed. So that's sequencing through statements. It's imperative style code. It's what the language is great at. If you do multi-value things, we have IEnumerable and IObservable. IEnumerable of T and IObservable of T can both be queried using link queries. So that's the language support for multi-value computations, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous. And the way you consume them for synchronous is using the for each keyword. For asynchronous, it's using subscribe. Those two are just, you know, twin brothers. We could have, you know, a subscribe keyword if the language chooses to do so, but in fact, because we have lambda expressions, we don't really need that. We just have a subscribe method. It just works great. So there you do composition on query expressions. You basically compose all those operators together. Sequencing now becomes dots. You say, like, I have a sequence, dot where, dot select, dot something with functions. So that's the way you sequence, and that's functional style of code, because you basically compose those little filters and all of those things together. So that's basically the landscape. Depending on whether it's single or multi-value, for asynchrony, you want to look at await and or Rx. And the two are complementary because everything that's task of T can also be converted to iObservable of T, so that you can use the Rx operators if you want to do complex event processing things on top of tasks as well. Which is the same here, right? If you have a single value that you do asynchronously, you can use link on top of that by wrapping the value in an array with a single element. So like that's exactly the same kind of dance to go to the other world. So that's basically the story I wanted to tell. Asynchrony is everywhere. Some APIs only allow you to do asynchrony, so you better be careful to know how to do it. You don't want to block the UI. The fact is that you have latency from networks, I/O, all of that stuff. You want to have a great application. So start learning about task of T, because it's one of those primitive things that the rest of the system builds on top of. Take a look at the async CTP. It's CTP quality, so if the machine is host, don't complain. Run it on a VM or something. And download the reactive extensions, which is also CTP quality, but we don't host machines. So with that, I want to actually wrap up. Thank you for your attention. If you have questions, I will stay around here. If you want to get some food, I think it's food time, or isn't it? It is, okay. Then, guten Appetit. That's German. Yeah.